Hi there, welcome back to the Safety Podcast. It's our first episode of 2019. It took us a little while to get started, but there's lots of great stuff lined up over the next few weeks, not to mention the rest of the year. So I hope you'll be joining us to keep on learning, sharing, and hopefully having more impact together. I'm excited to have our first guest of 2019 of the show today. His name is Matt O'Crowley of SusTrain. You can find him at sustrain.org. He owns his own consultancy now, but he has numerous years of experience working in the maritime sector across oil, gas, renewables, and more. Matt was keen to share with us how he has used his experience in some of these niche, high-risk sectors to make him a better consultant when he's transitioned across to own his own consultancy. This podcast is really packed with some fantastic insights from Matt. We touch on lots of different topics, including the International Safety Management Code, which is a maritime safety code. He talks about how that works really well. We also go on to talk about the importance of adopting the continuous improvement mindset for management systems. Keep an ear out towards the very end when we talk about management of change. Matt has a really interesting story about how a $5 saving at the supply chain end resulted in an $11.5 million loss.
Welcome to the Safety Podcast with your host, all the way from a small green island in the wild Atlantic Ocean, Richard Collins.
Thanks for sticking around for a call with Matt O'Crowley. Let's go over and join the call. Matt, welcome to the show. Welcome to the Safety Podcast. Thanks for coming on today with us to speak to us and dig in a little bit into your experiences within the maritime industry and across other sectors, all the way from Gran Canaria. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Hello.
I've obviously seen you on LinkedIn. You've wrote a couple of articles here and there. You're obviously very passionate and knowledgeable within the profession. Really, I'm interested just to hear a bit more about your background.
So, effectively, I went into the merchant navy, the shipping industry or transport industry, with the intention of stepping out as soon as possible. I didn't want to become a career seafarer, but what I did want was the training and the knowledge that goes with that industry to use in safety. And as a result, I never worked on ships carrying cargoes from point A to point B. I was working on ships that did a job. So very much within the oil and gas industry. So offshore in the North Sea, I was working on platform supply vessels, working on vessels building wind farms, looking at well stimulation, ROVs, all that good stuff. And then from there, we started the real job, and that's when I became a superintendent for QSHE, working on anchor handling vessels, well stimulation vessels, a huge variety of different ships, working along West Africa and the Middle East and what have you. So, you know, my sort of experience, my exposure to the shipping industry is quite wide and varied. I got some experience with ro-ro ferries, so what we call roll-on roll-off ferries with lorries and what have you, coming on board under their own steam, such as you see, cross-channel boats, and various other things in between. But it was a good grounding for what I do now, which is very much a sort of generalist health and safety consultancy, training services and other assorted hand-holding activities.
I think a lot of people will be jealous that you have that background, and obviously it sounds very very dramatic in terms of the places you've been and the types of things you've done, a massive scale sort of projects, and really high risk as well, which obviously you've got loads of excellent experience from. Has it been hard to transition back into the more general role from that position?
No, it's given me a fantastic grounding. A lot of people talk about health and safety as being a universal form of engineering. And I think that's very true. We are the people that are sometimes ignored when we're trying to prevent things from happening. But as soon as something actually occurs, we become the absolute expert in anything. it may be
that's true.
It may be a piece of equipment that, to be honest with you, we probably don't even know how to turn it on, and yet we're given the task to make it safe and make it operational. And you know, sometimes that could be a little bit frustrating for people. But my experience is very much when something goes wrong on a ship, or when something goes wrong in a country such as Angola, where I was for some time, where the value of their currency, the kwanza, has become so poor due to the United States withdrawing the dollar that they're using to support their own currency. We weren't able to get things into the country because it was absolutely impossible. So we had to come up with some very innovative solutions to some very, very minor problems. For example, you know, a slippery floor is a simple thing to deal with in the UK. But when you're in Angola and you can't buy non-slip paint, you end up sending a crewman to a beach in a little rubber boat to go and collect a bucket of sand. You know, you end up using other vessels that are going outside the country for a dry dock, effectively to smuggle in absolutely essential equipment, because the country you're trying to buy it in, you know, like I say, the currency had no value. Getting things into country was almost impossible. And the likelihood was that if you tried to bring in expensive parts or equipment, they'd be seized and more effectively stolen and then sold on. So you had to become very innovative. And yes, it was high risk, but the problems and the mistakes that happened were very, very simple. And in fact, the biggest mistakes and the biggest issues in health and safety generally come down to a very, very simple root cause. And that's something I always keep in the back of my mind, is to, you know, keep it simple, stupid, and to not overcomplicate the situation, not look at a big regulatory framework or a standard from ISO, panic about it and think, oh my God, we're never going to achieve this. Just look at it, simplify it, and find a way through. And that's very much how we deal with things in a high risk maritime environment. But we do have the benefit of a highly regulated structure around us. And that's very comforting, actually.
So now, whenever you're consulting, Matt, do you primarily work still within that sector, or do you, you know, have your eyes and work across a breadth of different areas now?
More and more, the demand is coming from outside of maritime. I still do get some requests from shipping companies and from port authorities and from other businesses that that have some arm within the maritime world. For example, people who are supplying to the maritime industry requiring a certificate of class for various parts or components that they're selling. But more and more, the demand is coming from general industry, especially with ISO 45001. Everybody wants it, but nobody, I don't think many people really get the simplicity and beauty of what's in front of them. They look at this thing and go, we're not ready for it. We've got so much more work left to do. You know, they're at a real tiz about, you know, just getting on and getting this accreditation. The reality is that when you look at it like that and you get in a panic, you start to see this ISO accreditation as some sort of prize for good work that you've already done. It's not. It's a system of working, and it's a commitment to continuous improvement. And continuous improvement is something that, you know, I always try and get people to see as an everyday task, not something that you look at a quarterly management review, not something that you look at when something's gone wrong or when an auditor is about to come. It has to be a daily event, and people have to understand it. And the frustrating thing for me is that in the maritime industry, absolutely everybody has had basic safety training. You cannot work in maritime without it. It's an absolutely compulsory thing to have. Whereas in industry, the people with safety training are generally the health and safety managers, the safety reps from the trade unions, or representatives of employee and safety. But it's a very, very small number of people that understand the subject that's in front of them. And yet, when you look at ISO 45001, when you look at many of the other standards, it talks about employee involvement, it talks about leadership involvement, it talks about everybody having a stake in safety management. That's the challenge, and that's where, you know, we've got to go a long, long way yet to get that engagement and involvement all across the board. Whereas in the maritime industry, it's mandated. We've got something called the ISM code, the International Safety Management Code, which, interestingly, is if any of the people listening have got OSAS 18001 or ISO 9001, whatever, you'll be visited by people from Lloyd's Register, from Bureau Veritas, from DMV, you know, these very, very prestigious organisations. And what people probably don't realise is that this stuff, this industrial stuff, is almost like a side hustle. The primary function of Bureau Veritas, Lloyd's Register, etc., is not as a certification body, but actually to act as something called a classification society. And they perform functions on behalf of governments in the maritime industry. And they come to every ship in the world, and they issue them with ISM certificates. They call them safety management certificates to the company, and each ship has a document of compliance. And these classification societies have got the power, effectively, to shut down a business. They can arrest a ship. They can stop it from sailing if the safety management on board is not to a high enough standard. So these people have an awful lot of power and an awful lot of experience and knowledge. And it's interesting when they come into an industrial setting. If you've got a dual purpose auditor who works in the maritime industry and in manufacturing companies and what have you, it's very, very interesting to see their reactions and responses to some of the things they see within industry. And it's rather wonderful to know they kind of share my view that industry in the UK and in Western Europe is very, very, very much behind the curve. Some of the new ideas around behavioural safety are very old ideas from the oil and gas industry and from the maritime industry that actually we're not pursuing anymore because we found that it caused more problems than it solved. Problem solving is very, very hot, especially in manufacturing, especially with Lean and Six Sigma. They're fantastic ideas, but I don't think that in the industry people really go into the detail of how to do it. I think there's an awful lot of waffle, and there's an awful lot of, we're going to do a problem-solving course, guys. A guy, someone from learning and development from corporate is going to come down, but he needs 5 days to talk to you about the five whys process. It can be done in an hour, and it can be done to a very, very high quality. That what frustrates me is that Five Whys is one tool. It's quite good. It's not the best. But we only ever use it when there's been a problem. We don't try and predict a problem and Five Why the solution before it happens, you know? We don't use it preemptively as much as we should. And I can't think of a good reason why that is. Is it because us as health and safety people, we kind of rely on people having the occasional minor accident to justify our existence? I hope not. What is the reason we're not using these tools that we have in our hands for, you know, proactive work as opposed to reactive work? In oil and gas and maritime, we do a lot of effort into predicting and preventing accidents and incidents from occurring. We have an awful lot of pressure put upon us by various governments because we're controlled or regulated by what we call our flag state, the country to which the ship is registered. We're also controlled and influenced by the country that we're visiting, port state. And both of these countries have the right, and they do, come and inspect and look for problems.
Has that made things easier for you in terms of justifying actions and so on? You know, has that elevated status perhaps actually been a benefit, or have you seen sort of negativity to it as well?
It's absolutely wonderful. The ISM code, it became mandatory, I believe, in 1998. And it it came from the International Maritime Organization, which is based in London, and it's a big international parliament, like the European Parliament. And all of the governments that sign up to the United Nations say that when bodies such as the IMO or the International Labour Organization, when they make a resolution, that we will accept it as domestic law in the same way that we've been doing with Europe for many years.
Yeah.
In 1998, the ISM code became mandatory for all of the IMO whitelist countries, which is basically every country that sells a flag to fly on a ship in the world. And it's a very, very clever document. The ISM code is very similar to some of the ISO standards. It gives you headings within which to work. It wants you to look at the operations of your business, how you plan it, how you resource it, and personnel. Very much the same as ISO 45001, OSAS 18001, all that sort of thing. But it goes one, maybe even two steps further. Where the ISO standards don't mandate, they give you freedom. The ISM code does mandate certain things, and those mandatory things are very much born from the reason that the ISM code was written in the first place. And the reason was that there was this very, very strong perception that safety failings in maritime were very much down to errors within the management teams. And the IMO pointed the finger directly at the ship owners, at the officers, at the support structures that need to exist for a ship to sail. They created a role now known as a designated person. It used to be called the DPA, designated person ashore. That role, that person, must have access to the highest levels of management. You can't argue it. You can't change that. The ISM code demands that your safety manager effectively has a direct line to the boss. Okay, so there's none of this, as we see in industry. You see a lot of safety managers kind of reporting into HR, reporting into an operations lead or what have you. Safety has to go directly to the top because there is an accountability by the top man or by the top team. And yeah, your safety guy needs to be in that team. And the fact that the ISM code, mandates that, it means that in maritime industry, no one has a choice. Safety is discussed at all top level meetings all the time. People are just used to it now. And the designated person has certain trainings that they have to go through, and that's all very, very good. And I think that's a fantastic thing, and I think it's something that industry could learn from.
Yes, I was going to say that to you. I think some of us are fortunate enough to have worked or are working with, companies that are more progressive and perhaps a little bit more developed in this sense, in terms of having, direct influence and engagement with the leadership of a business that you're working with or working for. But that said, there's a huge amount of people in the profession who, are still struggling with convincing senior management, and getting that buy-in, at senior level. So you've obviously mentioned there that the industry can learn from the ISM code. From a practicality point of view, is there any way you've thought, that we can say to health and safety professionals here that how they might go about actually achieving the same outcome without that code in place?
Well, I think it comes down to individual company policy. Why wait for a government or certification body to put that in place? You can do it with the will of the people. If the top management, if you can persuade them that actually, look, with the revised sentencing guidelines, actually mistakes that can be made on the shop floor by people that you've never met, doing things that you didn't even know that we did, these mistakes can actually, could bite you personally in the backside. And one of the things I've always said to people in top management is, look, it's a wonderful role that you have, but you have to remember that by having such a senior job, yes, you can buy a bigger house, yes, you can buy a nicer car, but if you don't take this seriously, and if you don't get involved in safety, that nice house and that nice car, they're at risk. because the courts and the health and safety executive are very much changed their attitude, and they want scalps and names to attach to health and safety breaches. Whereas before it was very much just, you know, give them the usual fine and walk away and find the next one. But people, you know, people are being held accountable much, much more than they ever have been now. And I think that's a good thing. But I like the idea of a designated person, because you rely less on having a good boss and more on having a good safety person. And companies that I've consulted with in the past, I always know that there's going to be a good boss who's interested in safety, because they've signed off my fee. You know, they want me on site because they want to improve, and they, you know, and so I always know it's going to be an easy win. But you know, that very much depends on having a good boss, and I think that's something that in the maritime industry it's less important, it's less critical, because there is that mandatory role that exists.
I think that's a big challenge for a lot of people, isn't it? You're sort of saying, you know, if you have a good boss, or if you have a receptive boss or set of leaders or you know, board of directors that is very open and receptive to hearing what you have to say and taking, you know, the right approach to it.
Yeah.
Not everyone is fortunate enough, obviously, to have that, but I think you touched on a couple of you know, valuable points there in terms of really trying to get the message home to them that at senior levels of businesses now, you know, it becomes a personal thing, and if you don't take the thing seriously, the repercussions could be, you know, extreme. And it's not a case of scaremongering, it's just reality now. So it's just maybe we have to get better at trying to communicate that in a way that's you know, that the people will accept. Well, the point you made about 45,001, I think, is really good as well, Matt. From my experience personally, I think a lot of people have lost the fact that there is freedom within those management systems to an extent, you know, to demonstrate how you are continually improving. And I find in my personal experience that whenever you take that, you implement systems to, you know, to make that live and to, you know, to bring it to life, that when it comes to auditing and the rest of it, that all becomes very easy, because at any given time, you're able to show an auditor that the system is live, it's doing what it should be doing. Yes, maybe there are things that are overdue or actions that, you know, are still pending and so on, but as long as it's live and it's healthy and things are being done proactively, that really, you know, from my experience, that really impresses a lot of people who come from the external environment to audit. And they're actually surprised when they see it, you know, they're actually surprised to see it. They're like, you understand what this is actually about then?
Yeah.
And I think it's a good message.
Well, I think it is, you know, I provide consultancy for these management systems, and you know, and I'll get a phone call from a company and they say, look, we're trying to implement 45,001, and I kind of think to myself, okay, I know exactly where this conversation is going to go, and then immediately it's so hard, it's so difficult, we've got so much work to do. And actually, as the conversation goes on, I always ask the question, you know, what was the first thing you did? Did you Google it, and did you try and download a management system? And generally speaking, most people think that they can download somebody else's management system, tweak it a bit, change the names, and boom, they get a certificate. Well, you know, I have had two clients that have done that, and they've been determined to stick with this downloaded, copied management system, because all they wanted was a certificate. And, you know, with both those clients, I said, look, you know, I can't work with you anymore, have your money back. Because, you know, To really get 45,001, in the same way as really getting ISM, you have to really want it, and you have to really believe it. And you also have to have absolute clarity of thought, not to be bogged down in policy and regulations and quoting things and that sort of thing. It's just, you know, look at what you're doing. If your business is making enough money to pay for these audits and these certificates and the safety managers and what have you, if the business is making that much money to pay for all of this, it's probably doing all right. It might not be doing things in the best way possible, but that's why you want to go down the PDCA route, down the continuous improvement route, to improve your business over a course of time. It's a lifestyle. It's not a decoration for the reception. And that's something I'm very, very passionate about, and I'd like more people to take that on board and realize actually all you're doing is writing down what you do, and then you're coming together on a regular basis looking at what you do and looking at ways to improve it. I don't think I can make it any simpler than that.
I love it. Love the simplification. I'm a massive fan of that approach myself, and really relate to what you're saying there. I don't think there's too many consultants that can turn around and say that whenever they were confronted by a client that just wanted to put a certificate on the wall that they would rather not work with them.
No.
I don't know how many of those there are out there. So that speaks to your approach, which is really good. And
okay, very, very simple. Oil and gas industry. People go, oh my goodness me, it's high risk. Actually, time it's pretty bloody boring. You're sat on a ship, and especially in the North Sea, you're waiting for the next interesting wave. So it's not this sort of constant action stations picture that most people have. So we have lots of time to stare at our navels and think about safety management systems, or I did anyway. But a lot of the work is about lifting operations. We do a lot of craning on and off of offshore installations. In the Middle East and in West Africa, we even crane people. We have something called I'd encourage you to Google this. Have a look at a crew transfer basket. They're fantastic things. I hate them. Now, in the North Sea, you would never see now.
You hate going on one, or you hate watching people going
both,
on
them? Both. I absolutely cannot stand them. But a lot of it is about lifting stuff. So, if you're lifting things all the time, you kind of accept and assume that at some point your lifting gear is going to fail. Even though you've got the best lifting gear that's available for sale, even though you go through all of the relevant checks, and even though you're getting contractors and what have you to check all your stuff, you just accept the fact that at some point, a ferrule will part, and a container or an Aggreko generator or whatever is going to fall a long way and possibly hit somebody and kill them. So what you do is you create exclusion zones. So if the worst happens, no one gets hurt. Yeah, simple. Very simple solution to a horrible problem. Now, when one of these Agrecos or containers falls because some of the lifting gear has failed, someone like me gets phoned and I'm told to go and investigate an incident. And actually, I sometimes scratch my head because I think, well, you've done everything that you possibly could. You've accepted that an incident could happen, and you've put in some fantastic controls to make sure that nobody even loses a fingernail. And it worked. So was that a success or a failure? And the companies, very often in the office, they see it as a massive, massive failure. But actually, it's not. Everything worked. It's a fail-safe. And yeah, all right, it's quite dramatic to see something fall out of the sky. But no one was killed. So that's absolutely fantastic stuff. So one of the things that we very, very prevalent in oil and gas and other high-risk places is this focus on planning for successful failures. And I think that's really good. It's not quite moved into industry yet, I don't think. I've not seen much evidence of it, but it's something I think you'll see more and more of. But the sort of top three things that I've seen in industry that makes me smile wryly, human elements or human factors is becoming very, very common. And I've sat through a number of corporate human factors trainings. And to be honest with you, they were pretty appalling. To get my certificate of competency, my license to be a deck officer in the Merchant Navy, I had to take an exam in human element leadership and training. To get my pilot's license to fly planes, I had to sit an exam in human performance and limitations. In industry, what's happened is they've taken the subject and they talk about the human factors, but they don't have an understanding and they don't really have the maturity to look at how you counter them. So yeah, it's okay to identify that fatigue and pressures from home and all this sort of thing become factors in an accident, but there's not much in the way of resource to counter that or do anything with it. Another one's behavioural safety. Behavioural safety was used very, very, very much in oil and gas and maritime many years ago. You will be hard-pressed to find too many examples of behavioural safety systems still in existence in those areas. Because whilst it was found that there was an immediate improvement in safety records and metrics, management and people started to use these systems because it was very, very heavy on reporting, and I don't know if you've got any experience with yourself, and it can become a form of bullying, and it can become a way to get back at people who maybe have slighted them in the past or what have you. It becomes very, very tiring. It becomes an unnecessary burden in the eyes of the workforce. And for those reasons and more, the trade unions, they went straight onto its moniker of BS. And a lot of companies in the end said, okay, that's enough. We'll back away from this. Unfortunately, as people back away from behavioural safety schemes, or as happens more often than not, as people lose interest in it, that wonderful immediate improvement in the safety record becomes an enormous nosedive, and things rarely get back to the stage that they were before the scheme started. So it can create an awful lot of work for you. And I suppose the third of my top three is management of change. Management change is an absolutely fantastic theory, fantastic subject, absolutely fascinating, but it's done so poorly. It's mandated in the ISM code, but it's done poorly in industry, it's done poorly in maritime, it's done poorly in aviation. You can't fully get rid of it. But what it does need is somebody who really understands the subject to come in on a regular basis and reinvigorate people and give people, some motivation to get on and do it well.
I think I can relate to all those points, Matt, particularly the behavioural-based safety, which is a direct experience of that being a real burden.
Yeah.
People just reporting for the sake of it, it took away any sort of autonomy and sort of proactive approach to resolving problems and so on, and just became a bit of an administrative nightmare. So actually, as a change to that in businesses I've worked in, I've made changes where it's implemented more so in a more sort of open and autonomous way within small teams, where problems are brought up amongst a group and they discuss it together and they solve it together, rather than someone reporting someone anonymously and sending it to the safety manager to go away and tell someone to do something about it, because that in itself is just for me really poor way of doing it, actually. And as you've already said, the sort of things that it can result in. Management of change as well, another one. It looks great on paper, but when it comes to the implementation of it, again, it can become very burdensome and it can be done very poorly. So from the management of change point of view, just very quickly, what does good look like to you from the MOC point of view?
What does good look like? With management change, it's about looking at everything from, I suppose if you're thinking about food, it's sort of from trotter to snout. You have to look at the business, the operation, the element you're looking to change, how it spiders out into everything else. And my famous story is about an MOC issue. I was asked to go and look at an $11.5 million loss incident in West Africa, where a ship had blacked out and was directly attached to a subsea oil well. And if the crew hadn't have succeeded in detaching from that well and getting rid of hoses and what have you, then you would be looking at the most enormous environmental incident. We're very, very lucky that that didn't happen. And Gulf of Mexico, double it.
Really? Wow.
Luckily, it was just $11.5 million down the tube, so that was fine. And I was asked by the company very, very strongly to look at the performance of some of the officers and some of the staff, because there was this idea that heads should roll. And using all the tools and the skills that I've got as a safety auditor, the root cause was a 12-volt battery that had been bought for a $4 saving in the purchasing department in Dubai. The lady that bought this battery even got a small bonus to say, well done for saving us some money. But actually, that $4 saving cost $11.5 million. You know when you hit a root cause, and some people talk about this, but maybe people don't talk about it enough, but you know when you hit a root cause, when if you take that element out of an incident, you can switch it off. And that, when you really get to that, and it's, you don't always find it, but when you do, it's a fantastic feeling. But it was a small change, a small engineering change that nobody knew about. It was just a new supplier that had been found. And the result of that was enormous. Not just for that particular company, or even though it was very, very bad for them it was a difference between a profit and a loss that year. But with maritime, there's a very, very strong culture of sharing near hits and near misses and incidents. We always say when something goes wrong, hey, we're going to be famous now. Because, you know, these get shared as a matter of course. And these batteries and people looking at their batteries, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, it became a master of problems. In fact, many of the companies found that they had worse batteries in worse condition that could cause, you know, the same results. Fantastically, they all got it solved, and you know it was a very good proactive measure with you know an industry reacting to something, not just a company. But that one 12 volt battery for me highlights management change. It also highlights having safety in the supply chain, which is something that is demanded by 45001.
Certainly, in the supply chain is something that can be easily overlooked. Do you think an MOC process done properly would have prevented that then? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, absolutely. Sadly, in this company, there was a very, very good MOC process. It was very simple. It's just that people found it dull. They didn't really see the need to do it because for some strange reason, there were some departments, purchasing and finance, seemed to step away from being part of the maritime family. They said, we're just buyers and we're just bean counters. And actually that is one of the areas where the failing crept in, because the ISM code demands that everybody is on board. It demands that every member of staff, whether they're working at sea or working ashore, they have to receive training in safety management, on a continual basis. It's not just put on the heads of, you know, two or three people in the business. Everybody's involved. It's a team effort. As a result, you end up doing a lot less, but achieving an awful lot more.
Well, that's a fantastic point to end on, Matt. I think that broader point of, you know, the supply chain team being detached from something that everyone else has bought into is a really big lesson, something that's great to take away for everyone listening. So, like, thank you very much for coming on the show. I think this has been really interesting. It's been great to hear your views and experiences, and I'm sure people will get lots of value from it. Good luck with everything you're doing, and hopefully we'll catch you soon.
Yeah, no problem at all. Thanks a lot.
I hope you enjoyed that call with Matt. We touched on lots of different topics there. Something to finish on, I think it was just important. The point he made about not including every department can be a very risky way to do business. Something maybe we should think about whenever we're introducing significant changes into the workplace. Another thing that really struck me there was the fact that he said about the management of change process in the company with the massive loss that they suffered. Although they had a system in place, it was so dull that no one wanted to use it. So it's just a little takeaway. We should be really honest with ourselves when we look at our systems that we use and things that we expect people to do and put ourselves into their shoes and really ask ourselves, would we want to use these things on a daily or a weekly basis? And if not, then there's probably an improvement there that can be made. So I hope you enjoyed the call, guys. There's more content coming up over the next few weeks. Make sure to tune in, hook up with us on LinkedIn, get talking, start conversation with us, and let us know your opinions on these podcasts. If you're listening on iTunes, which I know a lot of you guys do, and because we're providing this free content for you, it would be really, really appreciated if you're able to just drop us a quick, honest review on iTunes just to help us. As well as that, if there's anybody you know who might find this content valuable, it would be really cool if you're able to share that with them. Also, if you have a question or there's something you want to hear about or someone you want to hear from, just drop me an email to richard@safetypodcast.com and I'll pick it up and have a chat with you. So that's it for this episode, folks. Hopefully we'll catch you again next time. See you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Safety Podcast. We would love you to tell us which episode you would like to hear. Don't forget to give us a shout at safetypodcast.com.